Possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Are the many smarter than the few? We explore that question this afternoon with the author of The Wisdom of Crowds, Why the Many Are Smarter Than the Few, and How Collective Wisdom Shapes Business, Economies, Societies, and Nations. Our guest is journalist James Surowiecki. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker. He says a group that includes smart people, people of average intelligence and less than average intelligence, can reach a collectively wise decision, a better decision than one individual within the group might reach. In the right circumstances, he says, the crowd is smarter than the individual. At the outset of the book, he says, this may feel counterintuitive, as we always seem to be in search of an expert to answer our questions. Maybe we'll feel differently at the end of our discussion today. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion. I look forward to your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the Champaign-Urbana area, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. James Surowiecki has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since March 2000. Prior to joining the magazine, he was a writer for Slate. He's also been a contributing editor at Fortune, and he's contributed to numerous other publications, writing on subjects ranging from Silicon Valley to college basketball and the publishing business. His book, The Wisdom of Crowds, is published by Doubleday. 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. James Surowiecki, thanks so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thanks for having me on, Celeste.
Sure.
I appreciate it.
My pleasure. In the right circumstances, the crowd is smarter than the individual. Now, when a group is smart, you say it's smarter than the smartest people within the group. A couple of questions here to begin. What makes a group or a crowd smarter than any individual within the group? And what are those all-important right circumstances?
I think the answer to the first question is ultimately that a group is just able to draw on, well, two things. One is a group is able to just draw on more information and sort of rely on more diverse perspectives than any single individual is. So if you can really arrange it so that the group is made up of people who are, you know, bringing lots of different things to the table, and you can figure out a way to put all those different judgments together, you just have access to a much wider range of information than any individual can. The second thing, which is interesting, and I think maybe not as obvious, is that in the right circumstances, and I'll get to what those are in a second, the errors that any individual makes, the mistakes, so to speak, that any individual makes, get canceled out in a group. So that, you know, if we're trying to guess, I use these simple examples in the book as kind of images of what I'm talking about. If we're all trying to guess the number of jelly beans in a jar, if you have a group of, say, 50 people, You're going to have some people who guess very high, guess high, some people who guess low, and you'll have some people who are pretty close. But the extremes will cancel themselves out, so the errors that people make will cancel themselves out. And collectively, the group is going to arrive at a very good decision. That's pretty much uniform when it comes to simple problems like, say, a jelly bean guessing experiment. I think in terms of the circumstances, there are really three key things. The first is that you need the group to be diverse. I'm not really talking here exactly about sort of sociological diversity, but I'm really talking about kind of diversity of information and opinions. So, you know, I think we usually think of groups as struggling for consensus or compromise. I think that's really a mistake. I think groups are really smart when people in them disagree with each other, actually. And then the second thing you need is you need, relatively speaking, independence. So you kind of want everyone in the group to be making their decision, relatively speaking, on their own. The real paradox here is that groups are smartest when everyone in them is trying to be as much of an individual as possible in a way. And then the last thing is kind of really obvious. You just need a way of putting all those judgments together and sort of, you know, coming out with one collective forecast. So, you know, for example, at the racetrack, people have really different ideas on, you know, which horse is going to win or how likely it is for a different horse, for a horse to win. And everyone places their bets, and then at the end you come out with this forecast, the odds that are on each horse. That's kind of a model for how a good group can work.
Okay. And before, I've got a listener already lined up to talk to us this afternoon, but before I do that, I want to take care of one other important matter of business here at the top. Two's company, three's a crowd. How do you define crowd? What kind of group size are we talking about?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think actually the larger the crowd, the better, in the sense that the larger the crowd, the easier it is to have diversity, the easier it is to have independence, just because, you know, you don't have people knowing each other as much. But I would say, you know, anything over 30 or 40, you're in pretty good shape. But one of the things that's interesting, and I talk about this quite a bit in the book, is that there's quite a bit of evidence that even small groups, 10, 12 people, can reach very intelligent decisions and actually be smarter even than the smartest person within them. That's sort of surprising, because you would think either, you know, in a small group, if you have one or two people who are way off, you would think that would totally skew the group's decision. And you would also think that, you know, in a small group, it just would be easier for one person to really be, you know, there just aren't as many people, so it'd be logical that one person might really dominate. But in fact, there's pretty considerable evidence that you can get a lot of the benefits of collective decision-making even in relatively small groups.
Okay, let's talk with our first caller this afternoon, a listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Yeah, thanks. I wonder if your caller could comment on tragedy of the commons. And how that relates to this proposition that the group makes their best decisions when individualism enters into the formula?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question. You know, in my book, I actually cover a series of different kinds of problems. The problems that I think most people pay a lot of attention to in the book are the obvious ones where there's sort of a right or wrong answer. That's the ones I've been talking about so far. So how many jelly beans are in a jar? Which horse is going to win a race? I tell a story.
You know, it's a little subjective. The following is a little bit subjective, but like Tragedy of the Commons is essentially if you allow people to have free reign over a common area, that area tends to be depleted of resources over time.
Right. In the book, I also talk about kind of what I call cooperation problems, and the Tragedy of the Commons is an example of that. So one of the things I'm sort of interested in is how do large groups of people manage to work together when they have a kind of common interest? And that's sort of the example of the tragedy, of what the Tragedy of the Commons is. The sort of familiar metaphor of it is, if you have a bunch of farmers who have a common grazing land, and you know, each of them has cows that they want to graze on the land, the problem is that each of them has an incentive to have the cow eat as much grass as possible. But collectively, if everybody does that, then the grass disappears. And
right,
everybody
adding one more benefits the individual but not the group.
Right, everybody is worse off. Well, one of the things I talk about in the book is actually that there are these fascinating experiments that people have done in what are called public goods experiments. And they're basically trying to get at what you're talking about. How can people work together? And what you find is actually that a majority of people kind of want to do the right thing and are willing to act in the what's actually their enlightened self-interest, because everybody ends up worse off when the grass has been all eaten. But the key is really that you need to have, I think, two things. One is you need some mechanism for punishing violators. And the second thing is that you really want some sense of a kind of collective. People have to have the ability to recognize that they're in a collective enterprise. And one of the things I argue in the book is that this is more common than we think. So that even though we think about kind of, you know, the world is just pure competition, that there does seem to be a sort of cooperative impulse in us that in the right circumstances you can foster. So I have a whole discussion about how you can go about doing that.
Right. Well, thanks a lot.
Sure. Thanks.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. And to sum up here, would the smart decision made by a group be a moral decision? Would it be the ethical decision?
Well, I think one of the challenges in figuring that question out is whether or not you think that there is a kind of truth of ethical truth that is kind of true in the way that, say, the number of jelly beans in the jar is. If you think that there is, and I would say that, yeah, the group decision will be under many circumstances. But if you think it's not, then it's much more complicated. I think in the case of what we were just talking about, you know, another example would be, I don't know, say you wanted to get together as a neighborhood to build a fence. And everybody would be better off if the fence were built, but each individual person would be better off if they just sat back and let everyone else build the fence. In that case, I think there really is a collective good, and the challenge is really just, you know, getting people to agree to do it. What's interesting is I think people will agree to do it as long as they feel that any free riders will be punished in one way or another.
Yeah. I'm thinking of my grandmother at the moment. She had a couple of sayings. On the one hand, too many cooks spoil the broth, and then at another moment she might say, many hands make the work light. So, you know, there are differences in problems.
Yes.
What kind of problems are groups good at working on, and what kinds of problems might be best left to the expert?
I wouldn't necessarily say that there are problems that would be best left to, well, experts, actually, there are. I would say, for example, problems that involve a kind of level of pure skill. So let's say surgery or flying a plane or, you know, any of these things, I think you're probably better off just trusting an individual to do it. I think the problems I'm mostly talking about in this book are problems that involve decision-making and sort of forecasting the future. And in those cases, I think there's just very little evidence that individual experts can outperform groups. And the other problem is it's not just that whether or not individual experts can outperform them, it's you also have to be able to find the expert. You know, I think we kind of imagine that experts sort of announce themselves, and the evidence for that is pretty flimsy. So I think what groups are actually best at is if you give them a series of choices and you ask them to choose among them, you know, pick which horse will win a race, or which business strategy is best, or if you ask them to calculate, you know, the odds on an event happening. Those are really where groups are strong. So the alternatives are out there, and the group is picking them from among them. I think what groups are not really good at is sort of coming up with those alternatives necessarily in the first place. So, you know, putting a bunch of people in a room together and say, you know, come up with 10 or 12 ideas, you're probably better off just asking each individual person to come up with a bunch of ideas on their own. And so I think actually the two sayings, you know, the too many cooks spoil the broth and the many hands make light work, they both make sense in different circumstances.
Right. Let's talk with another listener.
Okay.
Listener in Champaign, line one. Go ahead.
Hi. I've got two questions for you. How does your book take into account the problem of groupthink or the mob mentality in terms of how it makes decisions? Both would seem to be arguments against your thesis.
Yes.
The second one is I'd also like to see how you deal with the idea that you had said just previously that, you know, free riders are typically punished, or free riders, you know, people who are not following the group rules are typically punished. I'm not really certain that that's true. You look at that in organizations and low performers on a team of workers, it's not the fellow team members, i.e. the group they're working with, that take any action. If any action is taken, it usually comes from management. You look at that famous example I think it was the 1970s, where 30-some-odd people heard the woman being raped, and everybody assumed somebody else would take care of it. There
right.
was a group of people who might not fit the normal definition of a group, but they clearly were members of a community, which is certainly a group. They all heard somebody clearly behaving badly, and nobody made any move to punish. So it seems like those are two possible holes in your thesis, and I'd love to hear how you respond. I'll listen offline.
Let's answer the second question first. I guess I was actually saying less that free riders are punished in a sort of description. I wasn't really describing the world, as I was saying that you need to make sure that free riders are punished if you want people to cooperate. So in a situation where everyone is, where free riders can just get ahead, then people are pretty quickly going to start free riding themselves. A great example of this is taxes. America actually has a surprisingly high rate of tax compliance. People pay their taxes at a much higher rate than they do in many other countries. And they do this even though in some circumstances it actually may be rational for people to cheat on taxes because the chance of getting audited is relatively low. But I think one of the reasons they do this is because we have this general sense that most people pay their taxes and people who don't have a chance of being caught. As that declines, as people get the sense that people are out there cheating on their taxes and succeeding, what happens is that people then become less likely to pay their taxes themselves. So you want to make sure that free riders are punished. The Kitty Genovese story, which is the story about the woman being killed and the crowd being silent, is a little, well, it's an interesting story because one argument for what happened is that basically people just assume that someone else would take care of the problem, and no one bothered to interfere because they assumed that if no one else was acting, that must mean that nothing was really wrong. Now that's an example of the group of people taking their cues from each other, and I think that is a major problem in group decision making. So to get to the first question, which had to do with two problems: groupthink and mob mentality. Groupthink is a real issue in small groups in particular. And I think what happens and it's really a testament to why you need diversity, which is one of the things I really stress in the book. The problem with groupthink arises when you have a relatively small number of people, generally who know each other or who have some kind of ideological similarity or are connected in some way. And what happens is that dissenting opinions sort of don't even really come up. They start to seem almost improbable. The famous example of it is during the Bay of Pigs, when the Kennedy administration just kind of blissfully assumed that these Cuban exiles would be able to overthrow and take over the entire island of Cuba with very little trouble, even though in retrospect it seemed like a remarkably foolish decision. And I think actually there's an argument to be made that if you think about the way the planning for Iraq, the Iraq War, and specifically post-war Iraq went, that there was a serious case of groupthink operating in the Bush White House as well. And so I think that that's something that you really need to be active in encouraging diverse opinions. You need to be active actually in making sure that the group is diverse to begin with. Mob mentality, we can talk about mob mentality a little bit later. I'll get to it. I think it's a really fascinating question, but I'll let you go ahead if you want to ask a question.
Yeah. And that's something that I want to talk with as well. So I hope that listener will stay tuned. Before I go on to the idea of diversity and dissent, which are really important here in the wisdom of crowds, I want to ask this question. Do we ever benefit from the free rider? I mean, haven't we all been in a group where we just would wish we'd had a free rider in the room?
You mean someone who just was doing nothing, basically, who was just sitting quiet, just sort of...
Well, somebody who's stirring things up in a less than helpful way, and you wish that do we need free riders? Do we need, when do we need to be leaders and when do we need to be followers?
I actually think I actually think the idea of people who participate in minimally, that is to say, is fine. But I do think actually that in a group, you really want everyone to offer their opinion. Because I think one of the One of the things I really think after doing this is that we don't really always know where good information and interest and valuable information is. And if we're not active in going out and soliciting people to offer it, we end up just not knowing as much as we should. But I think that this isn't really a question of being, you know, always a leader. I think the fear about free riders are people who are, you know, really completely just piggybacking off other people's work and not contributing at all. And in that case, you know, I think the group really doesn't really need those kind of free riders. So, you know, I think, you know, you definitely don't need everybody to be out there stirring up trouble. But I just would like, I think in a group, you should really try to get everybody's opinion if possible.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're going to talk about the importance of the devil's advocate here in just a moment.
Okay.
When I think of a group that we pin our hopes on to make a good decision, I immediately think of a jury.
Right.
And you write about juries in a chapter in the book that deals with the Columbia disaster.
Yeah.
Diversity is key here, and this is the cognitive diversity that
right.
we've touched on.
Right.
Maybe you would talk with us a little bit more about cognitive diversity, a little bit more in depth about that idea and its value.
Yeah, cognitive diversity, I think, you know, what we're really looking for are people who are bringing different kinds of perspectives, different kinds of information. So if you're, say, constructing a team within an organization, I think one of the strategies you might want to consider is bringing people from different disciplines instead of people who have all been trained in the exact same way. There's actually a piece in the Washington Post today by a guy I don't know. It's a very interesting piece about how he's using kind of a collective wisdom model to make decisions about his own cancer treatment. I think he's actually a doctor, but he has cancer, prostate cancer. And one of the things he says in there is that people tend to do what they've been trained to do. So surgeons tend to recommend, you know, surgery, and doctors who've been trained in other ways tend to recommend what they've been trained to do. And so, you know, you want to, if you solicit from lots of different disciplines, then you're more likely to get, I think, a coherent picture, a good coherent picture. The second thing about this that's sort of curious, and one of the most interesting things in the book, I think, is that diversity has value even if the people, the diverse people, are less intelligent, so to speak, than the ones they're replacing. There's a guy named Scott Page who's actually at the University of Michigan, and he's done these series of experiments. They're actually with computer agents, so they're sort of like computerized people. But he basically takes this group, and he has them solve a very complex, it's kind of a math problem almost. It's actually a geometrical problem. And so after it's done, he divides the group into, you know, the very smart people, the relatively smart, and then the okay smart people, basically. And then he reassembles them into groups and has them try to solve the problem collectively. And what he found was that groups that were made up of the smart people and some, you know, okay smart people almost uniformly did better than the all-smart group, basically. So that the mere fact of the diversity made the group more intelligent. And Page's theory, which I think there's a lot to be said for, is that people who are really, really smart, especially in a particular discipline, they tend to be very similar in their outlook. They tend to be trained in very similar ways. They tend to see the world in very similar ways. And so they're just things that are kind of outside their field of vision. And I think one of the arguments for the wisdom of crowds is you want to expand that field of vision. And one real way to do it is to bring in diverse points of view.
Mm. Maybe we could call that the out of the mouths of babes theorem.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, according to a former member of the mission control staff at NASA, James Oberg, NASA had more cognitive diversity in its early years. And this was really interesting because, as you note, that just seems not right. That seems counterintuitive.
Right.
So how did NASA become an agency with less diversity rather than more?
Yeah. Well, it really does seem counterintuitive because, you know, I mean, I'm sure most people, you know, if you've seen Apollo 13, the movie, or actually if you've seen the actual photographs, these guys in Mission Control, they all look the same. I mean, they're all wearing those white short sleeve shirts. You know, they've all got the crew cuts. They're all white. you know, they're all men. They all look basically the same. And, you know, you look at NASA today, and although obviously they're still a preponderantly a white male organization, there are a lot more women there, a lot more minorities there. And so it seems very strange to say that NASA was more cognitively diverse in the old days. But the reason it was, and I think it was, is because in the old days, most people who worked in NASA had come to NASA from outside the agency. So they had either been working in, you know, private industry, or they had come from the military, or they had come from the scientific community. And so they were really coming to it from many different perspectives. They had many different experiences. You know, their training was very different. And so you really had a kind of, you know, a mix of people. You had very high science people. You had, you know, these sort of more practical minded. And I think one of the problems is that as NASA, and if you think about it historically, it makes sense. I mean, NASA wasn't really established until when, I don't know, the early 1960s, I guess. And, you know, so there wasn't this long history of the agency. I think, you know, NASA today is populated much more by people who have spent, you know, most of their professional careers within the agency. And we kind of know, I mean, anybody who's been in an organization knows that organizations tend to socialize people. And it's very hard for people not to become in certain ways alike, you know, to sort of reflect the same points of view. It's really hard to see, out again, outside of the box, so to speak, that the corporation or the agency builds. And I think that's really what was happening. I mean, there's been a lot of work on and one of the things that makes this especially true in the case of NASA is that, as a lot of people have written about, NASA had a very powerful and in some ways, unfortunately, very negative culture. And I think it really did have a real impact on the way the mission management team handled the Columbia disaster.
Yeah. I can't remember the name of the journalist now who've written the book, but the book ComCheck is really a really interesting look at inside NASA and what happened.
Right.
So my apologies to those fine journalists.
We know another book about this that takes a slightly different perspective than mine, but is really, really interesting. It's a book by a woman named Diane Vaughan called
yes.
The Challenger Launch Decision,
yeah.
Which is really about the decision, obviously, to launch the Challenger in 86, which resulted in that disaster. And it's a very, very interesting look at the way in which, you know, an entire culture can take on certain attributes, and it's very hard for people inside it to offer alternative points of view.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist James Sirica. He is the author of The Wisdom of Crowds, Why the Many Are Smarter Than the Few and How Collective Wisdom Shapes Business, Economies, Societies, and Nations. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion. I look forward to your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local area, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. So if you're listening on the internet, for example, you can call us toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with another listener on line one. Hello.
Hello. First, I apologize. I didn't hear the whole program, so I hope I'm not repeating anything. But I was interested in corporate think or corporate ideologies and how they affect, you know, the states and the whole world. And I'll just start with another example about this groupthink on hormone replacement therapy. And I'm just and just in general, a case yesterday was when a gynecologist was on a show on WILL, and she was recommending a website about bone balance and osteoporosis, which she said was very good, and it may well be. But the host pointed out that this is sponsored by two pharmaceutical companies, and she said, well, you know, they also, you know, describe other medications, not by those pharmaceuticals. And in my experience, I've looked up medications I've been given on the pharmaceutical website, so that's important, but somehow when I do a further search from the NIH or you know, other sites, I feel that, you know, there's some holes, there's some gaps in what these pharmaceutical companies are telling me about the drugs that they make and the effect on my health. So I'm just wondering, I mean, like a doctor is hooked into the pharmaceutical companies and is being educated by the pharmaceutical companies, goes to medical school and, you know, gets, you know, a certain kind of a group think about women or estrogen or whatever.
Right.
And I've just seen, going back to The Corporation, the movie called The Corporation, which I recommend to every listener. I'm just wondering about how much, you know, people in corporations in the United States are able to think, or what the diversity is there. They have a certain ideology. They have a certain set of regulations which don't regulate them hardly at all. And there just doesn't seem to be much question about the morality of the way they operate. And yet in the movie, then they have people from, you know, outside the world that are being outside the United States, outside our world, so to speak, talking about the effects of the decisions made by these corporations on people's lives. And so you get a little bit of an outside perspective that questions what seems to be, you know, just an unquestioning ideology of capitalism that somehow is for the good, and yet it seems to have no moral standards whatsoever or no sense of responsibility towards the environment or human health.
Well, let me answer the first question, and then I can get to this. I should say, I mean, I am a firm believer in capitalism, and I think that, you know, there are obviously enormous problems with it, but I think that on the whole, I think it's superior. There's no other economic system that works. So I think that the case for capitalism is pretty, in terms of generating, you know, economic growth and essentially making the population as a whole better off. Now,
and destroying the environment at the same time.
Well, it's a complicated question. I mean, certainly if you were to look at the, I mean, we can get into a whole discussion about this, but if you look at the record of the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China environmentally, it's vastly worse than any developed country, developed capitalist country. I mean, there was
but
no
But what are we
comparison.
Doing now? Those, you know, that's my...
In any case, I think that the question about groupthink in terms of, let's take the medical community, I think that's actually an interesting, the HRT, the hormone replacement therapy point, is a very interesting one, because this was a sort of something that everybody assumed after a certain point, just agreed this was the case, and then, you know, the study was done very recently that basically suggested that, in fact, did not have the benefits that had been argued for it, and also obviously did not, in some ways, was actually even negative. Now, I think I have a chapter in the book on science, and science is a very interesting situation because on the one hand, you know, it does rely on the wisdom of crowds. You know, most scientists are not able to master their entire fields. There's this real sense of people contributing to the whole, you know, the things that get accepted as scientific dogma are really those that have been accepted by the scientific community as a whole. And I think that, you know, obviously modern science has been remarkable in terms of just look at the radical improvement in our lives. It's extraordinary. But there is a problem, and the medical community is a good example of this, where certain kinds of data and certain kinds of studies just get significantly more attention than others. And certainly data that serves the pharmaceutical company's interests gets considerable more attention than data that does not. And I think that in general, the more powerful pharmaceutical companies have become, the less intelligent, in a way, the medical community / the research community as a whole has become. If there's one thing I would point to as a real problem, and there's a move afoot to change this, it's actually that because pharmaceutical companies now fund and control a great deal of the research that's being done into drugs, bad news is often suppressed. I mean, actually contractually forced to be suppressed. And that, I think, is a real – is just a huge problem because, you know, obviously we can only be intelligent if we know what went wrong as well as what went right. And, you know, there have been some signs that that's changing. The FDA is now trying to set up a kind of a clearinghouse for all clinical trial information so that all clinical trials will have to be recorded. But I think, you know, this is certainly a case where I wouldn't really think of this as a wisdom of crowds problem. I think you just have a small number of people at the head of a small number of institutions, these pharmaceutical companies, which are exerting tremendous amounts of influence over kind of the medical or research community as a whole. So you're not actually getting a real view of what the research community thinks. It's all being refracted through the filter of the pharmaceutical company control of the research. So there, I think it's the crowd is not being allowed to be wise, so to speak, I would say, I guess.
So it seems that you do have some critique of the power of corporations. And
oh, sure, yeah. I mean,
what would you suggest that we would do to curb the power of pharmaceuticals to the extent that they're not just acting in their own interests and that they are actually acting more in the interests of the public good, those who are going to, you know, receive those medications, or
well,
from the scientific community for the knowledge of humanity?
Well, I think that there are a few things. I mean, in terms of the pharmaceutical company specifically, I think obviously the clearest thing to do would just be to shorten patent lives. I mean, you know, pharmaceutical companies get to sell drugs exclusively for a very long period of time, and if you shortened it, then there would be more competition, prices would fall, et cetera. But I think in terms of the research question, I think something like what I was just talking about is very valuable. That is to say that, you know, any academic doing research should be allowed to publish it regardless of who's funding it, regardless of whether or not the pharmaceutical company has paid for it. And any clinical trial, the results of it should be recorded and made public regardless of whether or not it suits the interests of the pharmaceutical company. I mean, that just seems relatively straightforward. It doesn't seem like a very complicated thing to do. It's actually perfectly legal. There's no major changes that would be required. It does seem like one of those things that's just self-evidently wrong, that if you hold a trial and the results show that this drug does not work the way it should, that you can just basically suppress it. You can't publish it as if it, you can't lie about it, but you just can suppress it. That seems like just a mistake.
Right, it's a mistake, but how can we remedy that?
Well, I mean, the FDA could just change that, or Congress could change it. I mean, I would just say let's pass a law requiring it or have the FDA issue a regulation doing it. I mean, how could that happen? Well, then you run into serious questions about the way the democratic system works, mm-hmm. and the lobbying power of the pharmaceutical companies, et cetera, which I think are real substantive institutional issues. But in terms of how it could be done, it certainly can be done. I mean, if we have the political will to do it, it can certainly be done, mm-hmm. and I would believe that it should be so.
I want to thank the listener for her call this afternoon, and we're drawn down on time. I've got another listener waiting to talk with us, so let's go and talk with a caller in Chicago on line 4. Hi.
Yes, I'd like to address follow through up with the previous caller's questions and others. the tobacco companies, I'll give an example where their testings and so forth seem to have denied that there was any detriment or addicting or other health problems associated with the tobacco usage, and yet when it came down to it, they finally had a fess up and paying the penalty, but still going on to exploit the use of an indulgence upon people who are using tobacco. And then to say that about capitalism being the present state of affairs we're in, well, this is only an avenue in which corporate greed has taken loose rein and exploited the creative accounting potentials to just victimize others and for their own self-aggrandizement. And we can go on and on in terms of areas of disregard and exploitation of resources and pollution and so forth. So the matter relative to capitalism, I would suggest that you check out Pete Peterson, former Secretary of Commerce, book Running on Empty, and it's not referring to the oil, but to the almost total fragile bankruptcy of the present state of affairs of our economy. So given the extent that we know so much now as a result of hindsight, we best explore what we have on the table now that your views and others are coming forth and enlightening us, and we can think in terms of the situation in the world now regarding the war. And I'm going back to the matter of individuality and groupthink. Former Secretary of State McNamara recently on the Charlie Rose Show pointed out in the confrontation between Cuba and the United States and Russia, there was virtually a nuclear mentality groupthink eminent, and one person in the group said, let's get a softer message through, and Khrushchev accepted the softer message, and we avoided the confrontation that existed. So,
well, you know, It's interesting because I actually just read 13 Days, which is Bobby Kennedy's memoir of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and it is very interesting to actually look at the way in which the Kennedy administration made decisions during the Cuban Missile Crisis versus the Bay of Pigs, which I was talking about. It's interesting because in 13 Days, if you go through it and you listen to what I've just been talking about, I mean Bobby Kennedy basically says that Kennedy, his brother, JFK, made a really explicit effort to solicit diverse points of view. He wanted to make sure that there were not sort of, you know, a set group of people who all had the same ideas in the room. He also was very active in making sure that people's status and rank did not dictate whether or not they were allowed to speak or whether or not
listened. Yes, McNamara pointed to some of that also.
Yeah, that all is very, I think, really, really important, particularly in small groups, about making sure, and actually I would say in organizations generally, whether they be companies or whether they be government agencies. I think one of the real problems in any organization is that hierarchies tend to dictate how information either emerges or doesn't emerge. And people who are higher in status tend to have a considerably more, obviously they have more authority, but they also just tend to be listened to more. And I think that one of the things we really need to recognize is that there are real benefits from trying to create a broader decision-making pool rather than just assuming that we kind of know, well, okay, listen to him and these other people we can kind of, you know, skip over.
Okay, well, thank you.
Sure.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Why is it that we value so highly consensus and compromise?
I think the answer to that is that there is a tension in small groups, and the tension is that groups that get along, where people sort of tend to get along with each other, and actually groups that are less diverse, probably have an easier time of kind of accomplishing a set goal if they know what they're going to do and they just have to, you know, go out and do it. It's easier to build group loyalty, to build cohesion. There's this fascinating study of soldiers during the Civil War that these two economists did, and they looked at Union soldiers, and they wanted to know, was there anything that made soldiers more likely to be to stick during a fight, less likely to run away during a fight, or to desert? And what they found was that soldiers who came from who were in companies that were kind of geographically and ethnically similar, so, you know, the whole company was made up of people from the same town or whatever, were much more likely to stick. So we have this, I think that's where part of this comes from. We want to get along. We want to sort of find that solution that everybody can at least sign off on. But I also think it arises from the fact that we misunderstand how valuable dissent and diverse opinions can be. And we kind of think, well, if we don't all agree, we won't be able to buy into it. You know, we won't be able to really get behind it. And so I am sort of talking about a mindset shift. You know, I really think for the ideas I'm talking about to work, and I do think these are ideas that can be really useful in any organization, I think for them to work, you really have to get, you have to shift your mind a little bit and say, even if we, you know, don't all agree with this, if this is what the group's verdict is, then we're going to go with it. And that, I think, is really key to making this kind of work in a way that you can use.
Yeah. In the book, you mentioned Cass Sunstein, law professor at Chicago.
Yeah.
And he's written a book about the need for dissent. Its publication followed September 11th. And it seems to me that there are times when dissent has a harder time flowering.
Yeah, that's very, very true. I think, you know, after September 11th is kind of an extreme example of that. But I think in general, dissent does have a hard time. I think people have a hard time. The way I put it in the book is actually not in the book, in a column I wrote afterwards, is that I think people have a hard time recognizing that dissent doesn't mean dissension, so to speak.
Mm.
And I actually think even dissenters have a hard time sometimes. You know, I think people who have alternative points of view sometimes worry that if they bring them up, they're going to, really pay the price. And in some cases, they're going to pay the price. So I think it is something you need to be incredibly active about, fostering and soliciting. I think it's, a mindset you need to develop. I mean, I think, the United States is complicated. And on the one hand, there are periods in our history that have been where we've been remarkably closed-minded and repressive, and dissent has really been completely you know, seen as unacceptable. On the other hand, in general, it's a relatively freewheeling environment, and you know, there are a lot of outlets for people to, especially now more than ever in some ways, a lot of outlets for people to be able to voice their opinions. So I think one of the real challenges is dissent within, as you'll guess, dissent within organizations, dissent within decision-making bodies. I really do think the Bush White House would have made, at the very least, a better and more reasoned decision if it had had more, if there had been more people in that organization who you know, had alternative points of view and were not all coming from the exact same perspective.
Yeah, that's a really important, I'm glad you said that there's a difference between dissent and dissension, and maybe we can think about that as we head into the election.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's really, yeah.
We got to wrap it up here. We're out of time.
Okay.
And I'm sorry about that. I think we could go for another hour
no,
at least.
It's an easy book to talk about.
Yeah,
a lot of
yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Our guest this afternoon has been James Surowiecki. He is the author of The Wisdom of Crowds, Why the Many Are Smarter Than the Few, and How Collective Wisdom Shapes Business, Economies, Societies, and Nations. The book is published by Doubleday.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by AgriGold Hybrids as an additional service to the many AgriGold customers in the AM 580 listening area. AgriGold, the corn specialists, on the web at a6395.com and at agrigold.com.
Let's find out what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. Wheat gave back everything it gained yesterday, while corn and soybeans consolidated below yesterday's highs. Let's look at the particulars. September wheat had a high price on the day of 320, a low of 311, settling 311.5, down 9.5. December, a high of 331.5, a low of 323.75, settling 324.25, down 8.25. March, a high of 341.5, a low of 335.25, settling 335.75, down 7. May, a high of 346, a low of 340, settling 340.5, down 5. July, a high of 347, a low of 343, settling on the low, down 4.5. September corn, a high of 233.5, a low of 231.25, settling 232.25, down 2. December, a high of 243.75, a low of 240.5, settling 242, down 2.25. March, a high of 251.5, a low of 248, settling 250, down 2. May, a high of 256.5, a low of 253.75, settling 255.25, down 2.25. July, a high of 260.5, a low of 258.5, settling 259.75, down 2. And September, a high of 262.25, a low of 260.5, settling 260.5, down 1.75 on the day. September oats, a high of 145, a low of 140.75, settling 142.5. That was up a half. December, a high of 151.75, a low of 146.25, settling 149, up a half. September soybeans, a high of 629, a low of 615, settling 620, down 3. November, a high of 611.5, a low of 603, settling 606.25, down 4.75. January, a high of 616.5, a low of 610, settling 612.25, down 4.75. March, a high of 622, a low of 614, settling 618, down 3.75. May, a high of 622.5, a low of 616, settling 619.25, down 2.75. And July beans, a high of 627, a low of 620, settling 622.5, down 2.5. September soybean meal, a high of 205, a low of 199.10, settling 199.30, down 5.40. October, a high of 185, a low of 182.10, settling 182.40, down 2.60. September soybean oil, a high of 25.02, a low of 24.45, settling 24.92, up 40. October, a high of 24.90, a low of 23.80, settling 24.19, up 18 on the day. The settlement prices are also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And Celeste, what do they have to show us today?
Livestock prices lower today, Dave. Let's take a look now at what happened today on the Mercantile Exchange. August feeder cattle, 118.70 the high, the low 118.30, the settlement 118.40, that down 20. September 114.45, the high 113.15, the low 113.30, the settlement, that down 145. October 112.45, the high 110.50, the low 110.65, the settlement, that down 225. August live cattle 84.60, the high 83.55, the low 83.60, the settlement, that down 120. October live cattle 85.60, the high 83.80, the low, finishing today at 83.95. That down 187 and a half. October lean hogs 65 even, the high, the low 63.20, the settlement 63.27 and a half, that down 142 and a half. December 62.25, the high 61.02 and a half, the low 61.22 and a half, the settlement, that down 107 and a half. February 61.75, the high 60.97 and a half, the low 61.47 and a half, the settlement, that down 27 and a half. April lean hog 61.20, the high 59.90, the low 60.95, the settlement, that up 50. August bellies, today's high 92.60, the low 88.90, the settlement 89.90, that down $2 today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 15 points at 10,088. The NASDAQ is off 5 points at 1834. And the S&P 500 off a fraction at 1,095.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Crystal Moran from Ripon, California writes, Dear Dr. Science, how is pemmican made?
Most of creation was manufactured by the supreme scientist, but there are a few things he, in his wisdom, declined to make. Among these are plutonium, polysorbate 60, and pemmican. Designed to resemble the flesh of the dung-eating pemmican bird, commercial pemmican ranges from rusty brown to jet black in color, smells like fermented beets, and induces nausea in those unlucky enough even to view it. Fortunately, pemmican does have its good points. Among them are being easy to talk to and preventing athlete's foot when worn between the toes. Of course, European pemmican bears little resemblance to American pemmican, and as of this writing, is obscenely expensive and doesn't smell nearly as bad.
Thank you, Dr. Science.
Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Ducks.